Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. We have got a quick read today that I've been debating with myself about how or when or if to do this one, honestly, or at least specifically on the show, because I think this one is going to be my first long read. If anybody has been to the website, you'll notice there is a tab called Long Read, and it says coming soon. I have been reading out Nick Szabo's amazing piece, Shelling Out the Origins of Money. And so I had been thinking about whether or not I should hit it on the podcast, because I still don't know exactly how to break it up. So it might be four pieces. So this might be four episodes. This could take up the rest of the week. But afterward, I'm going to put it all into a single audio file without the commentary and the music and everything, just to have it as a required listening, I guess you could say, for any new entrants into the Bitcoin and crypto economy space. And that will be a long read that you can just freely download. And Szabo also gave me full go-ahead to do any of his work in the past or future, so that's really exciting. He's been crazy generous with all of his work. I mean, all of it's just out there and free anyway. So this one is just an incredible, incredible piece, and if you have not read it, I would take the time either with these four episodes or when I get this into a long read format to sit down and tackle this one, listen to this one in full and very carefully, maybe a couple of times if you can manage it. I have read it now twice, probably all the way through, and it is just an amazing read. It is packed full of information, and it gives you a wonderful perspective on both the theory and really fun history of money. It also gives you a bit of a cypherpunk perspective. It is in fact Nick Szabo who elaborated on and coined the term unforgeable costliness, which in the recent episode of Vijay Boyapati's Twitter thread, you'll know, had a significant impact on understanding why Bitcoin will work as money, and was a key term for, or key theory around reframing the idea of what makes a money real, or what makes a money valuable and useful as that tool. So without further ado, we are going to jump into part one. Again, I don't know how many parts they're going to be. We will just kind of tackle this as we go. We're hitting part one of Shelling Out the Origins of Money by Nick Szabo. Shelling Out The Origins of Money by Nick Szabo, originally published in 2002. Abstract. The precursors of money, along with language, enabled early modern humans to solve problems of cooperation that other animals cannot, including problems of reciprocal altruism, kin altruism, and the mitigation of aggression. These precursors shared with non-fiat currencies very specific characteristics. They were not merely symbolic or decorative objects. Money. From the very start, England's 17th century colonies in America had a problem, a shortage of coins. The British idea was to grow large amounts of tobacco, cut timber for the ships of their global navy and merchant marine, and so forth, sending in return the supplies they felt were needed to keep the Americans working. In effect, early colonists were supposed to both work for the company and shop at the company's store. The investors and the crown much preferred this to paying in coin what the farmers might ask, letting the farmers themselves buy the supplies and, heaven forbid, keep some of the profit as well. The colonists' solution was at hand, but it took a few years for them to recognize it. The natives had money, but it was very different from the money Europeans were used to. American Indians had been using money for millennia, and quite useful money it turned out to be for the newly arrived Europeans. Despite the prejudice among some that only metal with the faces of their political leaders stamped on it constituted real money. Worse, the New England natives used neither silver nor gold. Instead, they used the most appropriate money to be found in their environment, durable skeleton parts of their prey. Specifically, they used wampum, shells of the clam Venus mercenaria, and its relatives strung into pendants. Image of a necklace of wampum. During trade, the beads were counted, removed, and reassembled on new necklaces. Native American shell beads were also sometimes woven into belts or other mnemonic and ceremonial devices that demonstrated the wealth and commitment of a tribe to a treaty. Clams were found only at the ocean, but wampum traveled far inland. Seashell money of a variety of types could be found in tribes across the American continent. The Iroquois managed to collect the largest wampum treasure of any tribe without venturing anywhere near the clam's habitat. Only a handful of tribes, such as the Narragansetts, specialized in manufacturing wampum, while hundreds of other tribes, many of them hunter-gatherers, used it. Wampum pendants came in a variety of lengths, with the number of beads proportional to the length. Pendants could be cut or joined to form a pendant of length equal to the price paid. Once they got over their hang-up about what constitutes real money, the colonists went wild trading for and with wampum. Clams entered the American vernacular as another way to say money. The Dutch governor of New Amsterdam, now New York, took out a large loan from an English-American bank in wampum. After a while, the British authorities were forced to go along, so between 1637 and 1661, wampum became legal tender in New England. Colonists now had a liquid medium of exchange, and trade in the colonies flourished. The beginning of the end of wampum came when the British started shipping more coin to the Americas, and Europeans started applying their mass manufacturing techniques. By 1661, British authorities had thrown in the towel and decided it could pay in coin of the realm, which being real gold and silver and its minting audited and branded by the crown, had even better monetary qualities than shells. In that year, wampum ceased to be legal tender in New England. In 1710, it briefly became legal tender in North Carolina. It continued to be used as a medium of exchange, in some cases into the 20th century, but its value had been inflated 100-fold by Western harvesting and manufacturing techniques, and it gradually went the route that gold and silver jewelry had gone in the West after the invention of coinage, from well-crafted money to decoration. The American language of shell money became a quaint holdover. Quote, 100 clams became $100. Quote, shelling out came to mean paying in coins or bills and eventually by check or credit card. Little did we know that we had touched the very origins of our species. Collectibles. Native American money took many forms besides shells. Furs, teeth, and a variety of other objects with properties we will discuss below were also commonly used as media of exchange. 12,000 years ago, in what is now Washington State, the Clovis people developed some marvelously long chert blades. The only problem? They break far too easily. They were useless for cutting, The flints were being made, quote, for the sheer enjoyment or for some other purpose that had had nothing to do with cutting. As we shall see, this seeming frivolity was, quite likely, actually very important to their survival. Native Americans had not, however, been the first to make artful but useless blades, nor had they invented shell money. Nor, for that matter, had Europeans, even though they, too, in ages past, had widely used shells and teeth for money. Not to mention cattle, gold, silver, weapons, and much else. Asians had used all that and faux axes issued by governments to boot. But they as well imported this institution. For archaeologists have found pendants of shells dating to the early Paleolithic that could easily have substituted for Native American money. Image. Beads made from the shells of the pea-sized snail Nassarius crossianus that lived in a nearby estuary. Blombus Cave, South Africa, 75,000 BP. In the late 1990s, archaeologist Stanley Ambrose discovered, in a rock shelter in the Rift Valley of Kenya, a cache of beads made of ostrich eggshell, blanks, and shell fragments. They are dated using the argon-argon, 40 argon to 39 argon ratio, to at least 40,000 years old. Pierced animal teeth have been found in Spain, also dating to this time. Perforated shells have also been recovered from early Paleolithic sites in Lebanon. Recently, regular shells, prepared as strung beads and dating further back still to 75,000 BP, have been found in Blombus Cave in South Africa. Image: ostrich eggshell beads, Kenya Rift Valley, 40,000 BP. Our modern subspecies had migrated to Europe, and necklaces of shell and tooth appear there from 40,000 BP onward. Shell and tooth pendants appear in Australia from 30,000 BP onward. In all cases, the work is highly skilled, indicating a practice that probably dates much further back in time. The origin of collecting and decorating is quite likely Africa, the original homeland of the anatomically modern subspecies. Collecting and making necklaces must have had an important selection benefit, since it was costly. Manufacture of these shells took a great deal of both skill and time during an era when humans lived constantly on the brink of starvation. Practically all human cultures, even those that do not engage in substantial trade or that use more modern forms of money, make and enjoy jewelry and value certain objects more for their artistic or heirloom qualities than for their utility. We humans collect necklaces of shells and other kinds of jewelry for the sheer enjoyment of it. For the evolutionary psychologists, an explanation that humans do something for, quote, the sheer enjoyment of it is not an explanation at all, but the posing of a problem. Why do so many people find the collection and wearing of jewelry enjoyable? For the evolutionary psychologist, this question becomes, what caused this pleasure to evolve? Image. Detail of a necklace from a burial at Sungir, Russia, 28,000 BP. Interlocking and interchangeable beads. Each mammoth ivory bead may have required 1 to 2 hours of labor to manufacture. Evolution, cooperation, and collectibles. Evolutionary psychology starts with a key mathematical discovery of John Maynard Smith. Using models of populations of co-evolving genes from the well-developed area of population genetics, Smith posited genes that can code for strategies, good or bad, used in simple strategic problems, the games of game theory. Smith proved that these genes, competing to be propagated into future generations, will evolve strategies that are Nash equilibria to the strategic problems presented by the competition. These games include the prisoner's dilemma, a prototypical problem of cooperation, and hawk-dove, a prototypical problem of aggression and its mitigation. Critical to Smith's theory is that these strategic problems, while played out between phenotypes proximately, are in fact games between genes at the ultimate level, the level of competition to be propagated. The genes, not necessarily the individuals, influence behavior as if they were boundedly rational, coding for strategies as optimal as possible within the limits of what phenotypes can express given the biological raw materials and previous evolutionary history. And selfish, to use Richard Dawkins' metaphor. Genetic influences on behavior are adaptations to the social problems presented by genes competing through their phenotypes. Smith called these Devol-Nash equilibria evolutionary stable strategies. The epicycles built on top of the earlier individual selection theory, such as sexual selection and kin selection, disappear into this more general model, which, in a Copernican manner, puts the genes, rather than individuals, at the center of the theory. Thus Dawkins' metaphorical and often misunderstood phrase, quote, selfish gene, to describe Smith's theory. Few other species cooperate on the order of even Paleolithic humans. In some cases, brood care, the colony of ants, termites, and bees, and so forth, animals cooperate because they are kin, because they can help copies of their, quote, selfish genes found in their kin. In some highly constrained cases, there is also ongoing cooperation between non-kin, which evolutionary psychologists call reciprocal altruism. As Dawkins describes it, unless an exchange of favors is simultaneous, and sometimes even then, one party or the other can cheat, and they usually do. This is the typical result of a game theorists call the prisoner's dilemma. If both parties cooperated, both would be better off, but if one cheats, he gains at the expense of the sucker. In a population of cheaters and suckers, the cheaters always win. However, sometimes animals come to cooperate through repeated interactions and a strategy called tit-for-tat. Start cooperating and keep cooperating until the other party cheats, then defect yourself. This threat of retaliation motivates continued cooperation. The situations where such cooperation in fact occurs in the animal world are highly constrained. The main constraint is that such cooperation is restricted to relationships where at least one of the participants is more or less forced to be in the proximity of the other. The most common case is when parasites and hosts whose bodies they share evolve into symbiotes. If the interests of the parasite and the host coincide, so that both working together would be more fit than either on their own, i.e., the parasite is also providing some benefit to the host, then, if they can play a successful game of tit-for-tat, they will evolve into symbiosis, a state where their interests, and especially the exit mechanism of genes from one generation to the next, coincides. They become as a single organism. However, there is much more than cooperation going on here. There is also exploitation. They occur simultaneously. The situation is analogous to an institution humans would develop, tribute, which we will analyze below. All right, at this point it gets into some really fun stuff about parasitic or symbiotic relationships between animals in the wild, and there's some really fun examples, but I don't think there's a decent stopping point until we finish this section, and the section is kind of long. So I want to keep this a little bit shorter today, and we will actually stop this one here and start back up tomorrow right where we left off. I'll give a little bit of an introduction maybe just to set us straight and make sure people aren't jumping into part two without having listened to part one. But that is, of course, the beginning of Nick Szabo's amazing piece, Shelling Out the Origins of Money. And I think you can already begin to see, if you have not read this whole thing before, if this is your first introduction to it, you can probably already begin to see how powerful it is, how powerful money is in its utility as a form of organization. That it is exactly the tool that prevents, that keeps people from having to trust each other, because you're in a situation where no other tool allows us to mitigate the actions of cheaters. And a society cannot thrive if cheating is not prevented. In the same way that a test does not give us any useful information if you cannot tell cheaters from people who are honest and actually taking the test. It gives us no useful knowledge about who knows what. And that's what money is. It's the tool to allow us to cooperate across all of these social boundaries and bad incentives to cheat or take from each other, as opposed to reciprocate our own productivity. So it's very easy to simply take someone else's productivity and use it to sustain your own life. The introduction of money forces cooperation where they would otherwise seek to cheat. It means that it makes it so that exchange doesn't happen on the level of trust, which is a tiny, socially unscalable means to make trade happen, and instead gives a medium by which to ensure that trade happens immediate, that like right when I give, right when they give me the smartphone, I give them the money, and vice versa. It ensures that the value is always transferred by having it in an exchangeable tally system that keeps track of everyone's favors to everyone else. But I don't want to go too much into it because there's a whole lot of fun stuff to cover, and we'll be hitting this whole thing. I'm going to try to make this about a four-part series, maybe. I might cut down on the commentary until possibly the last one. I don't know, but I'll have a little short thing to hit at the end of everyone for my favorite parts of the work, probably, at least for if nothing else. But do not forget to follow Nick Szabo. If you aren't already, you definitely should be. He is the quintessential cypherpunk. He's been a creator of BitGold, mentioned in the white paper, many precursors to the technology and the understanding that made Bitcoin possible. And he has just a huge body of work, which I will be hitting a lot of. I've hit many of his things in the past on the show, and I will continue to hit more by Nick Szabo in the future. But you can find all of his work. I mean, I won't be able to hit all of it on the show, so you can find a lot of it on the NakamotoInstitute.org. They have a little bit better readability versions of it up there, but you can always get it on his blog, unenumerated.blogspot.com. So definitely check that out. I will link to both the blog as well as, I'm actually reading this one off Nakamoto Institute, so I will link to that as well. And do not forget to follow Nick Szabo, the Nakamoto Institute, and check out that blog, because there is an ocean of great stuff to dig into. And of course, do not forget to follow me. You can find me at The Crypto Economy on Twitter, Mastodon, and Medium. I have been working on a lot of writing, and I hope to finally be done with one of my favorites by the time I finish reading Shelling Out. So maybe sometime early next week we'll cover it. So don't miss that one. I think it's going to be a really fun one. I think y'all enjoy it. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on iTunes so you don't miss parts 2, 3, and 4 of Shelling Out, because this is just an awesome work, and I'm going to have a whole lot of fun talking about it. And if you would like to support the show, I will always have my Bitcoin donation address available. You can find that either on the podcast page or on cryptoeconomy.life, where also when I do have this long read available, that's where you'll be able to find it, in the long reads section. And I had got a Twitter comment recently from somebody telling me they had donated, and that was really exciting. I hadn't had any donations in a while, and it makes me feel really, really good. And I hadn't actually checked the page, And I noticed I had 3 or 4 donations that I was not aware of. I got it all this past weekend. I just hadn't checked. So thank you guys for doing that. That is a huge, huge help, and it makes me feel really, really good to know that you guys are valuing the show. So thank you for that. And another way you can help out the show if you cannot donate or do not want to. I know it's a little bit annoying. I don't like the idea of asking for donations all the time, but I do want to keep this thing going as long as possible. So it really does make a difference. But if you would like to support the show in some other way, obviously you can always retweet, subscribe, post a review up on the iTunes store. I was really blown away when I first started getting reviews, how much of a difference that made in like my search results and showing up in people's feeds. So that is a really good way to do it, which, you know, only takes a minute or two and doesn't cost you anything. And of course, you can always check out the books I am currently reading. I'm now about halfway through The Drunkard's Walk. I've been listening to a lot of it on my errands, and it's getting better and better. I'm really enjoying that book. So if you would like to get that one or Mastering Bitcoin by Andreas Antonopoulos, both of these are amazing books. Drunkard's Walk is about a theory of randomness and its history of probability theory and how it really rules our lives in these fascinating ways. So that's definitely a fun one to dig into. And Mastering Bitcoin is the quintessential book on Bitcoin by Andreas Antonopoulos, and you'd obviously be supporting his work as well as mine if you get that through my affiliate link. You can get both of those things on cryptoeconomy.life, both highly recommended books. All right, and that'll be it. We will just go ahead and close this one here. Don't miss part 2 we got coming tomorrow for a continuation of Shelling Out, The Origins of Money by Nick Szabo. Until then, I will catch you all tomorrow. This has been the Crypto Economy Podcast. Take it easy, guys.